Hey guys and gals and non-binary pals, this is Courage and Spice, the podcast for humans with self-doubt, hosted by me, Sass Petherick. I'm a coach and supervisor, and I'm a little bit obsessed with how we heal the root causes of our self-doubt. On the podcast, you can expect interviews with delightful humans and evidence-based resources and original coaching tools. So if self-doubt is holding you back, then Courage and Space was made especially for you with so much love. I'm so glad you're here. Sophie Howarth is a writer, teacher, curator, entrepreneur, artist. She's based in London. She was the co-founder of the School of Life, and she has also been the curator of public programs at Tate Modern and a special advisor on social action in the Number 10 Policy Unit. She's also the author of several books, most recently The Mindful Photographer. And I know her to be a wise and contemplative woman of real depth. I love our conversations. It's been a while since our last one. Sophie, I'm so happy to welcome you to the podcast.
I'm so happy to be here. It has been a while. And I'm remembering that when we last spoke, you were supporting me through a really dense and dark and difficult time. And so I'm just enjoying noticing myself turning up today in a much lighter place, and how life changes. And I wish I could have seen that easier times were around the corner.
Yeah. Yeah. You're sparkling today. It's awesome. So awesome to see. I'm wondering if you can kind of place yourself for us. Like, where do we find you today? Where are your feet? How's your heart? Give us a sense of your world right now.
I'm in my son's bedroom, which I have sort of turned into my own art studio. This is a little point of tension between him and I. So somewhere in the corner is a bed with some cuddly toys, but mostly I'm actually surrounded by a lot of my own artwork, which I think I sort of hid away for a long time and have decided to like put up around me to kind of claim my confidence as an artist. But also, I actually wish that you could be here around the desk, because there's just tons of inspiration of the kind of, I suppose, the mentors and creative godparents that I have found for myself in life. And so I feel like I really surround myself with kind of pictures of people I admire, work by people I admire, quotes, bits and bobs, and it's a gorgeous space to be working in.
Amazing. I love that. How's your heart? Where are you at right now in your life? How would you describe that?
There are two words that come to mind, and they're kind of a bit paradoxical, really. I feel like my heart is fluttering, probably because it's buzzy and fun to be talking to you. And I also feel that my heart is very settled. I think that I have made my way a very convoluted way, and a way involving losing my way a lot, to something that my heart has been longing for. And I'm not exactly sure that I can define the shape of what that is, but I feel as if I'm not trying to get anywhere right now. As if, actually, there's a very beautiful line somewhere from a Wendell Berry poem. And he says, "There comes a day when the way is not a way, but a place." And I think I feel my heart is in a place. And we might explore some of what that place looks like. And some of it is very connected to physical place and nature. But also to what David White calls the house of belonging. I'm referencing lots of poets, and one of the places that I'm in at the moment is I'm really, really immersed in poetry. I've always really loved poetry, but this year I'm really working publicly with poetry and teaching a lot of poetry. And so I'm feeling as if I'm really kind of, that is my wayfinding tool. I'm so grateful to the people that have been able to put words around things I couldn't put words around. And you find your handholds and footholds often through the phrases of other people's work. So that's what the poets do for us.
So relate. You know, I went through a period over the Christmas holidays where I was just like wanting to shed stuff that wanted to go, that I just didn't feel like I needed it anymore. And two boxes of self-help books, psychology books, you know, all of that stuff went to my local charity shop. They were stoked. They said January is a really good time for self-help books. And I noticed that because I have a massive shelf of poetry, and I was like, oh, I think that's the problem. We buy too many self-help books and not enough poetry. So yeah, I'm with you. There's something about the brevity and the incisiveness of poetry that just gets to the heart of things.
And it kind of tattoos itself on your heart, you know, because it's
totally.
Poetry has to sound like something. It's easier to remember it. You know, why do we always remember lines like, you know, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in? We remember it because it's kind of metaphorical, because, you know, the word crack has a certain sound to it. It's so much easier to remember this than it is to remember points 1 to 5 of habits.
Yeah. As a coach, this is a constant battle. Yeah. Yeah. So I love this. And I'm really excited about your poetry course. I've actually just signed up for it. I'm totally with you. I think there's something that's calling me this year into, I got this. This might sound odd, but each new moon, I tend to do a bit of a tarot reading for myself. I don't really use tarot cards very much, but I quite like the meaning making that it presents. Like, what do I make of this? I think that's quite a fun way into my own psyche. And we've just had a new moon in January. And I learned the other day that it was a super new moon, and it's the closest that the moon has been to the earth in over 1,000 years. And there was something about that just went, woof, that's the cosmos is so just incomprehensibly large and full of possibility. That really struck me. And the reading that I did for myself, there was this very kind of clear theme of, it's safe for you to drop out of your mind and into your heart. Like, it's safe to do that. Because I've always found my safe place has been, I'm pretty smart, I can make sense of things, I kind of understand concepts quite well, that feels very comfortable to me. I've always felt like I belonged there. And there is something that's richer and deeper that is further down. And yeah,
I love that underneath what we are, we're something else, and that there are always these depths. But I also really want to honour that there are times when it doesn't feel safe to drop out of the cerebral and into the feeling space. And I think it's really good to sort of to trust when we hold back, that that is a kind of necessary self-protection, that staying sometimes in a thinking realm isn't like a lesser thing. It's a really great thing. And but of course, when we can move in and out almost in an orchestral way between our mind and our heart, that's when it's really exciting, because we also can't live totally only in the realm of feeling and heart stuff. We want to have our mind in service of that. We want to, in order to get our things into the world, and in order to be able to kind of critique and edit and tussle with ourselves in a encouraging way.
As you're speaking, I've got this image in my mind of like the infinity loop. And that there, for me, there's always been this kind of like the mind and the body out, they're still part of the loop. But there's the heart, it feels like the crossover point in the middle. And I think that's the kind of, I've always been pretty good at kind of spinning around the loop, but actually sitting in that center point feels like, it's like the pause in the middle. It feels really quite yummy to me right now. Yeah, I mean, it's not a very good word, but, you know.
a clear out can be such a good way, of course, can't it, to see a clear out of bookshelves in particular, and you get surprised by the things that you find you want to keep. There's not always a logic to that. Yeah. But you can also see underneath all the big piles what is there, and maybe sometimes remember why you bought something at a particular time or how a book came to be. And I love that sense that books like ideas, like dreams and wishes, can often be sitting around latent and unopened for a while. Mm-hmm. And you know that wonderful thing where sometimes you open a book and you're sort of sure it's going to be really difficult or not quite right, and it turns out to just be like delicious and readable and wonderful, and you suddenly enter into another world that is inside the pages. And I always find that if I'm reading something I'm not very inspired by, I can't make any time for reading. And then as soon as I've got a good book, time just sort of magically appears from all these little orifices of the day.
I'm struck by that. Like, one of the words when I think of you, one of the words that really sits for me, that feels like a match for me, is this idea of contemplation. Like there's something about the conversations we have, there's always a real depth of thought that is going in. It's like a felt thought almost that I sense from you. And I can kind of see as I was putting together like this little intro, I was thinking, oh, there is a thread of that, like through your work, this giant invitation for us to just slow down and kind of notice our lives.
I mean, I'm really touched by you saying that. I do feel a contemplative person. Sometimes I feel like a person who just needs to go at a much slower pace than everyone else. And sometimes that feels really difficult. I'm like, could the whole world just dial itself down to 50% of the speed that's normal? And at other times, I feel okay about being a slow person. So one of the things I notice is, you know, I really prefer walking places than like cycling places or taking public transport. And I'm not a photographer myself, but I do try and I have a little sort of daily practice of trying to take one photo a day just on my phone. And walking really helps you notice things. And I think that like tuning ourselves into noticing, it brings so much depth, but it can't be done in a hurry. You just can't do it if you're busy getting from A to B in a race. And of course, there are times where we have to be in a hurry. But slowly, slowly, it just feels as if things reveal themselves the more we have almost, well, this podcast is about courage. Like if we have the courage to slow down, the spice turns up.
There's something that feels quite rebellious about slowing down as well. And in terms of like our cultural narrative is efficiency, productivity, it's all of those lovely things that capitalism rewards.
I think sometimes I have times where I think, oh, I'm going to get rumbled. I'm going to get found out for having a bath mid-morning or for, you know, not doing anything on my to-do list for a week. And I wonder what that's about. Is there some kind of fear or shame in the idea of getting found out that... that I want to be able to be slow in private. But because, I mean, talking to you makes me think about self-doubt. And I think the relation, what's really changed for me is that I've always been somebody who likes to do things quite slowly and contemplatively. And I doubted whether that was okay. And now I don't doubt it so much because I just feel more confident that that's what works for me. And that's what leads to my best work, and that's what allows me to find life more rewarding and to find more ordinary delight, more everyday awe, more just of that kind of stuff that is everywhere in the ether, but we aren't tuned into it when we're hurrying. It makes me want to read another poem. Can I read a poem?
Sure.
You asked me what was on my desk. So this poem is on my desk. It's called Ode and it's by Zoe Higgins. Here's to everything undone today. Laundry left damp in the machine. The relatives unrung. The kitchen drawer not sorted. Here's to jeans unpatched and buttons missing. Dirty dishes. The novel not yet started. To Christmas cards unsent in March. To emails marked unread. To friends unmet and deadlines unaddressed. To every item not crossed off the list. To everything still left, ignored, put off. It is enough. And I suppose I feel as if we have to be okay with that stuff in order to then be able to just kind of, I don't know, savor the undoing, savor the not doing. Savor the moments where the light comes through your window for just a moment and is on the wall or makes a shadow. And you can't, it's not going to wait for you. Like the moon isn't going to wait to be closer to the earth. Yeah. It's up to us. Do we want to pay any attention just for a moment or do we want to not because we're rushing? And of course we can't be in that state all the time. Mm. But sometimes just making peace with all the things undone, all the people that we failed to get back to, all the, you know, ambitions that we're not pursuing, allows for this kind of really loving space of just being with what is. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's the key, isn't it, to gratitude stuff, is that lots of things can be really difficult, but we can practice finding what we feel grateful for. And there seems always, I always feel with the word gratitude, that there is something kind of awkward about the idea of it. And you sort of
it's
feel
kind
like
of worthy, isn't it?
Seems so like tedious to be asked, and yet it's completely bloody transformational. I mean, yeah. I can't yeah. bring myself to use the word gratitude, but I have a little tiny notebook where I just keep a record of good things. Yeah. Pretty much the same things most of the time, like mostly my dog. but I know, and in a way, one of the great things is that I don't have to be original there, that I don't have to like write nice prose, that it's not in any way meant to be poetic or meant to be sort of creative or valuable, but it just is a way to train those noticing muscles and to kind of, you know, battle that negativity bias that we all have that, you know, is there to keep us safe, but keeps pulling us towards being in a state of high alert and in a state of panic and in a state of looking to, you know, what's wrong, what's around the corner, what's threatening. And I feel as if, you know, we aren't living with predators, or maybe we are, that's a whole other conversation, but so we do actually have to kind of take responsibility for training our brains to focus on other things.
Yeah, completely. I'm just thinking about as well the last line of that poem, and I love it when women poets bring in the mundanity of life. Like, how grounded is that? But this idea, this is enough. It's enough. And I'm just thinking about that idea of unlearning, undoing. That's how we get to this place of enoughness.
And maybe use the word mundane. Maybe the mundane is enough. I mean, the magical is inside the mundane, isn't it?
The ordinary.
Yeah.
For a long time, I've been reminding myself that, you know, there is magic in ordinary. I don't have to be extraordinary.
And if we're bored, and we all have times where we feel bored, and we feel particularly bored with chores and ordinary stuff, but it's not really the chores. I mean, you know, that's what the mindfulness people are so good at, that they can make the folding of laundry feel magical again. And so to be asking ourselves, why am I bored? Because we can be in a most amazingly exciting and stimulated and brilliant environments and still feel bored. Bored is a state of mind, not really a reflection of what you're up to. And so with this challenge to take a photo a day, you know, it's usually the same walk, the walk to school and back. Mm-hmm. And I think, well, what can I see differently? What can you see differently by going on the same walk? And I noticed that whether I can see something differently has everything to do with how much I'm ruminating or how absorbed in myself I am. And that for me has been what I've used photography for, is to make me look out instead of looking in. I mean, I love looking in, but there are times when it just feels really good to look out and to stop going over and over your own thoughts.
It reminds me of what you're talking about, reminds me of one of Sharon Blackie's books about, and I think it's even in the first chapter, and she talks about a woman going for a walk in the woods on a Saturday or a Sunday. And in the first walk, she's worried about work on Monday, totally in her own head and pissed off that it's raining. And it's all very kind of internal. I'm not even looking out, you know. And then in the second walk, she's like taking in her surroundings and noticing that the annoying noise on the first walk is actually a blackbird, and she realizes it's a crow, and the crow is following her on her walk, and it becomes this quite magical encounter. And I often think about that, like how many times I go with Bodhi, our dog, for a walk each day, and you know, I have stopped taking my phone, so I don't do the photo thing, but I'm trying to. I've made friends with a tree in our park. I notice I take a moment just to notice how the tree's doing each day. There is more of a presence that is there in that moment. And it's a 20-minute situation. It's not like a really long hike. But I come back from that walk thinking I've connected to something that's not me, and I feel differently when I walk back in the door.
Yeah. And it's a political thing, this business of reclaiming our attention. Our attention is scattered, so advertised to, so colonized, so interrupted, that to practice reclaiming it and to be practice placing it on what we want to place it on, and just to remind ourselves that we have it, that it is the one resource that no one can take away from us. And yeah, it's our power to use our attention how we want to.
Hey, if self-doubt is holding you back, I want you to know about Self-Belief School. This is where you learn how to heal the root causes of your self-doubt and how to create robust and resilient self-belief, self-acceptance, self-worth, and self-trust. They're the best kind of selfies. I want you to see who you are underneath your self-doubt. Just head over to selfbelief.school for all the details and how to enroll. I'm struck by that a lot, that privacy, attention, these things that happen without an audience, that aren't shared, that aren't for anyone else except ourselves and our beloveds. These are the really precious resources that we have.
And I think probably when things do emerge and want to feel shared, it's best when they emerge from that. Like when they emerge from your own, what practices you found sustainable for yourself, what things are genuinely bringing you delight, what you're really curious about for yourself. I mean, one of the things that I have noticed in this sort of eclectic, I don't know, I can't call it a career, but eclectic kind of curation of activities that has kept me feeling vibrant for a long time, is that I have a tendency to call in other people to be alongside me in finding out about something. It's so exciting to always have a beginner's mind, to be being curious and to be curious with other people in community. But it's so wonderful to be co-investigating life with others.
Yeah. Before we hit record, you were sharing about how you've created some different circles in your world. I wonder if you want to share a bit about that. But yeah, we were talking about the juicy time of midlife and what it's like to be here in this very fertile time, as we're, you know, physically losing our fertility. Actually, it can, for a lot of us, be the most vibrant period of our lives, or the beginning of that.
I started doing a lot more gatherings in my house after I separated from the father of my children, and I suppose I was trying to work out how to bring life back into my house. I was also in need of community, and I also had the house empty half the week. And so I started calling in a lot more, doing a lot more circle work and calling people in. And then I felt that I really wanted to be in a longer investigation with other people about what it was to be in midlife. And I guess midlife for me at that time meant being, well, the place I was feeling in was a place of feeling very lost, that there wasn't a clear pathway. Mm. And of course, there's another side to midlife, which is the kind of coming into our power and recognizing, there is no path. The path is made by walking. But I was just more feeling like I've lost a lot, and I'm feeling very lonely and very confused, and who else is out there who's feeling that too? And I put out an invitation to say, I need a band of pilgrims. Let's go on a pilgrimage through our ordinary lives together for a year. Like, who wants to? And you know, if you've got two broken legs right now, probably this isn't the moment. You know, you need to be up for the long walk, and up for the fact that on a pilgrimage we're on our own journey, but we do it alongside others. So I was really embracing what it could be to be doing a pilgrimage right within the ordinary fabric of your life, not having to go somewhere special. And yeah, I put out this invitation and people responded, and I didn't know them. And we met every month for a year. And it was like living many lives, because there were the things that were going on for me, but then there were, you know, the things that you discover that are going on for other people, many of them very classic things to be going on midlife, to do with, you know, looking after elderly parents, or some people dealing with children leaving home, or big shifts and losses of identity and career, changes in one's body. But also, you know, the way that we're always all the ages we've ever been. So there's this thing that you are looking back on things that have happened to you earlier. And, you know, as we grew in trust and confidence over the year, that would also involve looking back on some difficult situations on some abuse and other things that happened to people that they felt able to bring. And there was also so much laughter and so much joy, and we played so many daft games. But I really felt as if I called in the community I needed. And I also noticed at the end of that year that I wanted to pause, you know, that, you know, we have times when we feel that we want to do public work and be around other people, and times when it feels nice to be quite reclusive and to be processing these things on our own. But I mean, this year I've been calling in who wants to be around me to make poetry a daily habit. And I'm like, well, you know, the best way to stick with a habit is to have other people helping you be accountable for it. So I'm like, who wants to come on this journey? And I don't know what other journeys that they're in the future. I'm not so wedded to there being a really clear plan as just to thinking, well, every stage, like, let's see who else is out there who's also interested. Let's get curious together. And it's such a lovely way to find the people that you need to meet at any given time.
Yeah, I love that so much. I'm really excited about it. It was just a very instant thing of, oh, yes, please, more poetry. And my husband bought us a beginner's pottery course.
Yeah.
In our local community, we've got like this communal garden, and they've got a pottery shed and a kiln there, and we're quite excited about making some pretty shitty pots together.
Well, here's to being beginners. Let's just constantly
totally. But I'm and just really like, me, oh my goodness, poetry and pottery. I'm good.
Actually, I think of midlife. I think one of the things that midlife means to me is a process of beginning in the middle. We're always beginning in the middle, but in the middle of a day, you can be beginning in the middle. Like, there's this sense that all is not lost, that there are fresh starts and second chances and new ways of perceiving things always available all the time, in the middle of a project, in the middle of a conversation. Like, we can just start over and we can think, oh, is this where we're going? Or do we want to talk about something else? And that sense that we, like, I mean, if we think about nature, it starts afresh all the time. This is... Yeah, we're just about to watch that over the next month, aren't we? Where it has another go.
It has another go. I love that so much. Yeah, I'm just noticed this morning we've got daffodils coming up in the park, that just the shoots, the early green shoots. And it's like, oh, the hope that that gives me. Oh, it's starting again. Okay, good, good. I'm ready for that start. That bleakness of winter is starting to feel a bit heavy.
Well, the light makes such a difference as well, doesn't it? But I also do enjoy that after the kind of, there's often a bit of a pressure around the beginning of January and New Year's, new energies and all of that. And I love that nature claims it's hibernation for so much longer than that. It's like, no, I'm going to lay low for quite a few more weeks. I don't need to stick my head above the parapet till we're well into February.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's composting time. Just enjoy it. Yeah. Yeah, I really have felt that this year. And I'm wondering if it is part of, I've noticed that a lot with the people I'm close to as well. There is this almost like a giving in. Let's just withdraw early, like rather than fight it, you know? And I wonder if it's partly our age, or if we're just, maybe it's partly to do with the pandemic, you know? What does a changed life look like? All those promises we made to ourselves when we were running a school from the kitchen table.
I feel, well, I can say for myself, you know, whether it's staying in a relationship too long or panicking about letting go of work, or not always trusting my gut when I just know something doesn't feel right, and it's not a hell yes, so it should be a no. Why do I sometimes hold on to things? And it's fear, of course, isn't it? Always. But you can't know what you're going to let come. You have to do the letting go first.
Yeah. And that's often quite discombobulating. I don't know who I'll be if I let this go.
Well, I often think of life as being like a series of chapters. And, you know, we don't know what the next chapters are going to hold. Like, a few years ago, my life looked really very different from how it looks now. I was living, you know, with two young children and a male partner in a house in London. And now I live on 50 acres of salt marsh with a woman that I love. And we have five children between us. And that wasn't really a change that I could see coming. It wasn't something that I was going out in search of, but it was just like letting go of a life that felt really difficult to stay inside, that through no one's particular fault, just was like ill-fitting everybody involved. And it's been really interesting to see my children transition through, you know, what is it to be a child inside a family that isn't working?
Yeah.
And we're always told that, you know, you must keep things stable for children. But ultimately, I feel like the biggest gift I can give my children is to thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also to exemplify the courage of following your heart and doing what you need to do. And I think, you know, there's all the things that you can tell children, but if you can show them that it's okay to let go of things and that new things will come and that the thread you follow, the integrity, is the one thing that you can really depend on.
It's the courage, right? To let the spice in. So what is capturing your heart this year? Tell me about your plans, your dreams that are capturing you right now.
So, well, I'm working on quite an exciting project up in Scotland, which I've been working on for about a year, which I'm not sort of quite ready. I don't know when this podcast is going to come out, but hopefully by that time I'll be able to send people a link. But I've been working on creating a retreat space on the far northwest coast of Scotland, which is an area that I have a lot of connection with. And I have had, you know, a long history of social entrepreneurship and engagement mm-hmm. with sort of creative ways of working on equality. And I felt that I wanted to do something that was tangible again after perhaps all the virtual experiences mm-hmm. of lockdown. And making spaces, making home is a thing that I really love to do. So I've made a little home there, which is going to be exclusively for nature restoration for people who have been on the front line of the cost of living crisis and of the sort of post-COVID injustices in Scotland, to just go and pause and rest. And it's not a retreat in the sense that there's nobody there to look after them. It's really just a place to have a break, have a holiday. That might involve doing some thinking. It might involve doing no thinking at all. It might involve taking your family. It might involve going on your own. It doesn't feel like it's for me to tell people what they need. I know that nature will provide what people need. It's a very tiny house surrounded by awe and majesty of beautiful mountains. But I just think that there are, you know, I see so many people so burnt out from caring and from mm-hmm. serving, and the chance to be in a place. So I'm really trying to kind of curate the home with my partner Sarah. It's very much a joint project. She's a landscape designer, and we're shaping this place to be somewhere where you just feel you can exhale, mm-hmm. you know, where you can arrive exhausted, where you can collapse, where there's permission to stop and look. There are these two big windows and you look out onto, you can see the Isle of Egg and the Isle of Skye and the birds and the creatures walking in front of you. So that's kind of my biggest project for this year, is to make this small home and welcome people and just like make it an open heart and see who needs and wants to come. So we're mostly partnering with Scottish voluntary and community organizations who will themselves let us know who needs to come. So I'm not pretending to be the expert in who needs it most, but we'll partner with the organizations that know. But it feels there's something I think about shaping something that is exactly what I would want for myself and offering it mm-hmm. to others, rather than this slightly more distanced approach where you think, oh, something's good enough for me and then I'll help other people in some other way. I just think I want what's brought me back to life. I want what's restored me, which is space, beauty, nourishment of nature, permission to stop and slow down and do nothing. I want that for others.
Mm.
And I suppose back at home, I feel like I'm just continuing on this path that doesn't have a destination, but which is just to pay attention to the everyday. I'm working on a new little book called Everyday Wonder, which just consists of kind of being like things that we can see with an open mind,
mm.
I suppose, you know, what's always there. Mm. And also with a hint of the sense that, you know, we often talk about like sound frequencies, that we can only hear certain things. And I think the same thing applies to visuals, that, you know, we see
Usually.
What we're looking for, or we don't see other things. So I kind of love that playfulness that, you know, like magical portals are everywhere if you look at things differently, or stories are everywhere in the urban fabric. So just, I'm just enjoying paying attention to, I don't know, pavements and railings and signs and like not spectacular stuff, really ordinary stuff, and allowing it to inspire little stories and just everyday delight. And I really want to say, you know, in the name of transparency, that I do not find this like possible all the time. You know, yeah. I'm also wrapped up in my own shitty thoughts, and I'm also forgetting to look. And I, you know, there could be a murmuration of starlings above me and I wouldn't even see it because I was like thinking about something grumpy. So, I mean, I feel like I practice this stuff because I need to, not because it's easy and not because I feel like I have any special talent around it, but just because I suppose through long, long trial and error, I felt like that is the best way to look after my mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. I think that's the thing, is there isn't a there where the shitty thoughts aren't there, where the frustrations with other people and yourself aren't there. That's magical thinking about a destination that doesn't exist for anyone. And it's like, this is enough. This is enough. And you just can look at the same enough place, this ordinary mundane life that most of us lead, and go, oh, this is enough. And can I love what I have? And can I notice that one thing that might lift my mood one degree? Okay, that's cool. Yeah.
And that for me, I mean, I've never been very good at sitting meditation, but the only thing that it really has helped me with is the sense that, you know, you do it and you're crap at it, you know, you do it and you lose track, and so you just have to keep coming back and coming back, and you have to make peace with being useless at it. And I suppose that's the same thing of like being, just noticing myself distracted, noticing that I didn't see something, noticing that I found walking down my own street dull, or it's just a kind of reminder to come back, to just be like, the magic is there. It's just, I wasn't tuned into it. Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of perpetual failure that feels like it's the invitation to keep coming back, to keep being a beginner, to try, the older, the more expert you get, to just keep like peeling back and getting fresher. I have a very, very favorite E. Cummings poem, "I thank you, God, for this most amazing day." And at the end it says, "Now the eyes of my eyes are open. Now the ears of my ears awake." And I just love that sense. It's like literally peeling away your own senses. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but it's arrived at by this kind of perpetual failure and this perpetual compassion with oneself for the failure. That like not to be calling a truce with myself, which seems to be more frequent. I'm less often disappointed and frustrated. I remember that, I mean, you've spoken a lot about disappointment on this podcast. And I definitely remember that when you and I worked together, disappointment was like my word. I mean, I was just disappointed in everything, but most especially in myself. And I'm thinking that the same things still happen, but the orientation is like more about curiosity and less about disappointment. I'm just a lot nicer to myself. I mean, I had a brilliant, brilliant therapist when I was sort of in the thick of divorce. And she said, "You're really mean to yourself." I mean, she didn't say it like, she said it in a much nicer way than that, of course, being a therapist and all that. But it was so powerful to have it mirrored back to myself that I was being just quite mean all the time. Yeah. And I feel perhaps of all the things in the last 5 years, the thing I feel most proud of is that I've learned to be nice to myself. Everything else has flowed from that.
I'm so with you. I think it's the voice we hear most often. And it's like, can you imagine if you take that mean voice and characterize it as a being in your life? Like, it would be a flatmate you can't wait to get rid of, right?
Yeah. But also, if you're practicing meanness to yourself all the time, then you probably are more mean to other people. I mean, I'm a lot kinder to people sort of immediately around. I'm certainly much kinder to my children by practicing kindness to myself. When I see that they're, you know, tired or unfocused or those kind of things, I think, you know, I'm there too. And nobody needs to be kicked when they're down, least of all oneself.
Mm. And I think as well, one of the things I've noticed in my own experience of being compassionate is that you allow more compassion in from other people too, right? It's like, oh, that person's being really kind to me. I'm going to let them rather than fight them, you know? And that can make all the difference.
It's funny you use the word kind. It just makes me think about times when I have been so full of self-loathing that if someone was kind to me, it just pierced me. It was almost unbearable. Like, I
Yes.
considered myself to be so unworthy of kindness that it was really hard to receive it. So I'm also thinking that by practicing kindness to oneself, you also become more capable of receiving other people's kindness, which then is supportive of there just being more kindness around that can be expressed. And this is beginning to sound a little bit like as cheesy as the gratitude thing, but you know, what can we say? I mean, if we can get over the cliches, there's a real compassion, gratitude. These, in the end, are the qualities of mind that I structured my book about mindful photography around. I thought it's not really about how to take photographs. It's about how to become a person with more humility, with more compassion, with more gratitude, with more curiosity. So there are 13 chapters or 16 chapters, I think, and each one is a quality of mind. And the idea is, how can we use looking at the world? How can we use photographing? Might be photographing ourselves, might be photographing loved ones, might be photographing nature. It's not really about the pictures we take. It's about how taking those pictures can transform us as people to be practicing these virtues. When I look at the book, the thing I feel really most proud of is the contents page. I just see this list of qualities, and I think, well, for me, I want to read a book that is about those list of qualities. And also, I don't think people typically open a book about photography and find that it says clarity, curiosity, humility, compassion, and so forth.
That was the thing that struck me the most about it, was just this idea of, oh, this is a huge invitation. This is quite subversive of you, right?
You have to make whatever you're working on, you have to make it interesting to yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like this, the working on oneself is really what we're always all working on, just in the guise of different projects.
All of the different stages of our lives, all of the different places that we are in, and the relationships that we allow, they're all places where we get to figure out who we are. It's the work of our work is, and who am I in this? And who am I now?
And
And
maybe that's how we know the places we shouldn't be in. Because if we are in places or with people or doing work that isn't an opportunity for figuring out who we are, for expressing ourselves, then probably that is not a person, place, or work that we should be doing. Maybe that needs to be our criteria
And we
for.
don't have to make it mean that we're wrong, or anyone else is wrong, or that thing is, or that place, or that work is wrong. It's just, oh, it's not a fit. This doesn't fit. Okay, next.
And also, I don't think it means that the work has to be incredibly profound or explicitly all
No.
about finding yourself. I think in any, in the most ordinary thing, what's that classic phrase of, you know, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. So it might be in, you know, it might be in cooking something, or it might be in, you know, going to the DIY shop, or it might be in the ordinary errands. It doesn't have to be only in the spectacular things. I mean, I guess that brings us back to the fact that for me, it's always the ordinary fabric of everything that is the most interesting.
I love that we're talking about this. I remember when the pandemic started and we first went into lockdown, I had a few days, weeks, even, I guess, like most self-employed people, where I just thought, oh, this could be it. Work could dry up. That might be the end of this part of my world. And there was this almost like pre-grief for that, even though nothing had changed. And we didn't yet know that the whole world was going to go online. And actually, for a lot of people, it would be quite a busy time. But I remember thinking, okay, I'm going to just go through what I sometimes do, which is, well, what's the worst case scenario? And I got to this place where I thought, oh, okay, what is the most tedious, role that would feel completely out of my, like, you know, excitement. And I thought, okay, packing shelves at our local co-op. And I got to a place where I thought, actually, if I was doing that, I would be part of our community. I'm going to get to know all of my neighbors in a different way. I'm going to show up as me. I would start again in the middle.
Yeah.
To use the phrase.
So that is liberating, isn't it? To feel that
it was so liberating. Yeah.
You could let things go. And that also being really humbly of service, I think for many people in the pandemic, that was the place where most meaning was derived. And, you know, wonderfully, we came to really appreciate the people whose work was most necessary.
Totally. I mean, the satisfaction of making sure people were fed and cared for and they knew where the bargains bin was, all of that. It just felt like I could make that work. I'm good. And it was like the panic kind of dissipated.
Because you weren't trying to hold on to things, what did emerge for you in that time?
It was quite fascinating because in that time, I then went, oh, okay, if I'm going to do this work, so far it hasn't fallen apart. If I'm going to do this work, I'm going to do the thing that I've been waiting to do for years, which was to start teaching my methodology. So this whole new chapter of my work emerged out of
that. Was only in lockdown. Wow. I feel I'm always talking to people who've benefited from that. I can't believe that was only
it's only 3 years old. Yeah. Two and a bit years old. Yeah. I'm
beautiful to think that you had to, some things had to fall away for there to be space for something that you'd been longing for to emerge.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd convinced myself, well, I probably need to get my doctorate and blah, blah, blah. I had all these stories about who I needed to be able to do the thing. Classic self-doubt, right? We have to be overqualified.
Well, we must have some more qualifications. That's always an essential.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Drop out of the head into the heart. And yeah, and it was very much like an invitation. Why not now? Why not you?
I hear in what you're saying that voice becomes more powerful, but the other voices are still there.
Totally. I still have moments where I'm like, what do I know? Like the humility of being a human that is thinking all the time about being alive and making sense of our world. I'm struck often, and I've stopped really paying attention to too much news. My nervous system can't really tolerate a whole lot of it. But I do often have moments where I think the world's kind of on fire. Like, does this even really matter? And I have to sort of like stay in the integrity of, well, it doesn't matter to everyone, but it does matter to someone. And it's not my job to put the fire out. It's my job to do my work.
And it's really paralyzing being only with the big things. And of course, I feel that we mustn't turn away from the big questions, but nevertheless, all we have to work with, we still have to live in days, in hours, in small actions. And I think it is very, you know, humans didn't always have to lurch between the global picture and the everyday in quite as extreme a way as we do. And in a wonderful way that we are being encouraged to, and we really need to think more about future generations and to think sort of have more long-term thinking, but it's quite dizzying and it can make it, I mean, I've definitely had phases where I just felt like everything felt pointless in the face of that.
Yeah.
Except
it's an existential threat. And it's that thing, isn't it, where so there is almost nothing left to lose. Can we show up to the existential threat of a planet that is in collapse? And can we do that with our values and our creativity and our curiosity and our compassion on show? Because if there's a way through it, this collapse, it's through those qualities.
And I have so, so much admiration. I'm so grateful for the people who are big systemic thinkers and who are able to really kind of address the large scale in the future. But I know, I can say for myself that the fastest way for me to make no contribution is to feel dogged by the question of whether my contribution is valuable enough, whether it's big enough, whether it's significant enough.
Yeah.
And that there's something, I sometimes think, you know, what am I doing with it? Like these, like all these kind of small activities. Yeah. And then I think I'm just feeling and finding my way. I'm doing the best I can. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to be a decent person. I don't have to be a spectacular person. Mm-hmm. I'm letting go of needing to save the world and just trying to appreciate the world. And of course, yeah. I think the more that we do come to love the world in front of us and to love ourselves in it, the more likely we are to want to protect and save it. You just aren't motivated to look after and care about something you don't notice and you don't pay any attention to and you don't love. And the work of loving the world and of loving the people in the world happens in a microscopic way. It happens person by person, difficult person by difficult person. It happens like thing in front of us by thing in front of us, hour by hour. And we get, and yet somehow it, in that process, we are becoming people who won't stand by to watch it destroyed. But you know, it can be easier to love like mankind, that individual.
Oh, yes. Yeah, love humanity. Kind of can't stand a few humans.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, a colleague, Kelly Deals, she's a Canadian writer and feminist and general all-round good person. She talked a few years ago, she mentioned the way that she thinks about feminism and, you know, bringing down the systems of oppression. And she said, I just picture all of us lined up next to each other, and there's a brick wall in front of us, and all of us are just slowly pulling out one or two bricks. And that image just moves me so much. And I think, yep, okay. So, what are the bricks?
We might be singing while we're doing it as well.
Yeah.
So we might be having a good time pulling out those bricks.
I'm pretty sure we are. Yeah. There's behind us, there's, you know, trestle tables full of food, and there's some dancing. It's a good time. Yeah.
I mean, that is so key, isn't it, that to avoid burnout and to avoid also, you know, the sort of entangled activist problem of contributing to the world that we want to critique, is that we have to make the work joyful.
Yes.
It has to be fun and loving and kind. And I mean, so many people, but particularly Adrienne Mee Brown, are so brilliant on this. It, like, activism has to be pleasurable. You have to want to come towards it and be part of it.
Yeah.
And if it's too heavy-handed, then there's nothing more off-putting.
Oh, there's got to be humour in it and humanity in it. Otherwise, what's the freaking point?
So now I'm going to think about the brick wall party.
Nice. I love it.
I hope
I'm there. Put my name down. Sophie, thank you so much for being here today. What a total joy to see you sparkly.
That's the word I'd have used. It has been a joy, hasn't it? So fun. Yeah. I can't believe that an hour has gone past already.
I know.
It's just mad. Really energising and connecting and true to talk to you. Thank you so much for the invitation.
Oh, you're so, so welcome. Be well.